It's the morning show, and we're talking about the migrant crisis at the southern border. And here is some context. The sheer number of migrants who arrived in our country this year, especially families, it overwhelmed U.S. Border Patrol. In the first 6 months of the year, federal agents apprehended more than 500,000 migrants at the southern border. So what do you want to know about the experience of reporting on our immigration system? Join in this conversation at 800-642-1234. Caitlin Dickerson is a national immigration reporter for The New York Times, where she's broken news about changes in deportation and detention policy. She's currently the journalist in residence at UW-Madison's Center for Journalism Ethics. Caitlin, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, take us right away to the border. You have been there even in recent days. What is it like?
I actually spent last week at the border. I spent half the week in Brownsville and McAllen, Texas, in the Rio Grande Valley at the southern tip of Texas, and then went a couple hundred miles northeast toward Laredo. These are two cities where hundreds of migrants, especially migrant families, are clustered and waiting. Because what's happening, waiting to enter the United States, that is, because what's happening is, as you know, the Trump administration in its early months faced legal challenges, strong legal challenges to its attempts to restrict the asylum system. Most of the new policies that were introduced only lasted a few months and then were shut down by federal courts, essentially. But they're experiencing a sort of sea change now where the policies are starting to stick and have a real impact. So I met with families in Matamoros, Mexico, for example, a very dangerous city, a city where the State Department has advised American travelers against visiting because of the risk of kidnapping and the risk of violence. And folks there are waiting. You know, first they waited several months under a policy called metering that made them essentially wait in line to get to the U.S. border. Then they were enrolled in another policy, which has prevailed in the courts, known as MPP, or Remain in Mexico, which requires them to wait in Mexico for the duration of their asylum cases. Now, as of just a couple weeks ago, they're facing a third bar, which is one that was approved temporarily by the Supreme Court while it's being adjudicated in federal courts, known as a sort of transit ban, which requires them to have applied and been denied asylum in a different country that they transited through before they're even eligible in the U.S. So prospects for these families that are waiting along the border are quite grim.
Yeah, and the latest Supreme Court ruling is basically shutting down Central American families from coming into the U.S. unless they have origins in Mexico. Is that right?
Essentially, yes. So the rule, like I said, it requires people who transited through any other country on their way to the United States to have applied for asylum in at least one other place before they're eligible to apply here. Practically speaking, that makes things really difficult for Central American families, because I can tell you that some of the countries that they're transiting through on the way to the U.S. have, you know, a dozen asylum officers for the entire country. There are also, you know, countries that many people are fleeing from. Places like Honduras and El Salvador are not countries that most people want to apply for asylum in, because many people are fleeing those countries. I mean, the issues, the violence, the domestic violence, the gang violence are prevalent throughout Central America, and that's really what people describe running away from. I should also say, you know, there's this big debate across the political spectrum about whether most of the folks who are arriving in the United States are economic migrants or whether they're legitimate asylum seekers or neither or both. And what I find when I go to the border, as I often do, and talk to people, is that people describe a mix of motivations for coming to the United States. It's really not that simple. I mean, the asylum system is this very narrow set of legal constraints that we've created where people are only eligible if they're fleeing persecution. But often those folks also have economic needs. And so it may be the case that they were living in great danger, but because they couldn't feed their family, that was why they actually picked up and left. It's a mix.
You've written a lot about family separation, children being separated. Earlier this year, you wrote about the youngest child separated from a family at the border was 4 months old. What was that like?
So, yeah, that was a Constantine Mutu, youngest child separated from his family. And he actually spent 5 months living with a foster family outside Kalamazoo, Michigan. So by the time he got back to Romania with his family, he lived the majority of his life in federal American custody. A traumatizing experience, unsurprisingly, for Constantine, who was obviously too young to talk about it, but also for his parents. I think their case is an important one to talk about for several reasons. One is that they were separated after approaching the legal port of entry in actually Matamoros, Mexico, where I just left. Constantine went up to the border with his father. He was in his father's arms, and his father handed over their passports and birth certificates and requested political asylum, and yet they were still separated. It's important to recognize that that happened to many, many families last summer. When you would hear the Trump administration talk about the idea that they were only separating families for as a punishment for having crossed the border illegally. But in fact, many families, Constantine's family, also Ms. L's family, Ms. L is the named plaintiff in the federal lawsuit that prompted the family reunifications. Both of those families presented themselves legally and yet were still separated.
We're learning about immigration policy and deportations on the U.S.-Mexico border with the help of New York Times national immigration reporter Caitlin Dickerson. How has the immigration crisis in the U.S. affected you and your family? How do you want to see lawmakers responding to the border crisis? Join in at 800-642-1234. We'll continue this discussion just ahead here on the Ideas Network. You're with us on The Morning Show as we examine the border crisis. The Trump administration is taking steps to limit applications for asylum. And then we saw, as we were talking about the Supreme Court, allowing the administration to enforce a policy preventing nearly all immigrants from Latin America to qualify for asylum, except those of Mexican origin. We're looking at this through the lens of a reporter covering it on the ground. What do you want to ask about the process of reporting on migrant families in tent cities? We're at 800-642-1234. Be part of the conversation with New York Times national immigration reporter Caitlin Dickerson, who stays with us. Let's go to the phones now. Craig is joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Craig.
Hi.
What is on your mind about this immigration conversation?
Well, you know, the first thing that needs to happen is our federal government needs to do their jobs that they haven't for 50 years and do some comprehensive immigration reform, making it easier for people to legally get into this country, which would keep people from trying to do what's going on now with these migrants from Central America. But regarding the caravans from Central America, one of the things I think needs to happen is they need to investigate where the organization and funding of this comes from, because this isn't just people that decided one-on-one that they're going to walk from Central America up to here. They've been organized and their trips have been funded from somewhere.
Craig, thank you so much for the call. Caitlin, what is your response there? As we talk about comprehensive immigration reform, it is a phrase we hear a lot.
Mm-hmm. A phrase you hear a lot, but one that doesn't ever amount to anything under the last several administrations, as Craig points out. And I appreciate his question. With regard to the idea that folks coming from Central America are getting some sort of funding or encouragement, I mean, I think it's an interesting and good question to ask. But it's important to note, I speak with officials who work for the Department of Homeland Security on a near daily basis, and they actually have a lot of intelligence on folks who are coming up from Central America into the United States. They have people who are infiltrated within those groups who are providing intelligence, just like you do in any international relations situation. And I've personally never been presented with any evidence that there is some secret funder of large caravans of people. In fact, you know, what's interesting is that the whole country was talking about caravans last summer and started paying attention to them. But as someone who's covered immigration for many years, caravans have come up with asylum seekers from Central America for at least the past half decade. So it's really not a new phenomenon. But, you know, I think where Craig is coming from is the numbers and how impressive they are and how surprising they are and what that says about immigration policy. As for whether Congress will come together on comprehensive immigration reform, at this point, we don't have any evidence that they will. It's interesting hearing the Democratic candidates for president talk about their ideas for immigration. A lot of them just talk about basically reversing what this administration has done. And it's hard to see Congress coming together. But until they do, we're going to have so many complexities within the law that make it really difficult for people to access relief in a legal and straightforward way.
Over the summer, we saw the devastating photo of a man and his infant daughter washed up on the Rio Grande. How did that image that just reverberated all over social media, especially, how did it change people's view of what is happening at the border?
I think it gave people a sense of the desperation and a sense of, you know, again, going back to this question many people have about the reasons why families are coming to the United States. And when you see a parent and a toddler who've drowned, who've washed up on shore, I think it raises a question of, you know, what is it that motivated them? And it must have been something pretty compelling for them to cross the Rio Grande. I mean, I just left Matamoros, which is where that father and daughter drowned. And more recently, just actually last week, another parent and toddler drowned in that same portion of the Rio Grande. And yet, as I talked about, there are hundreds of people waiting there trying to get into the United States. They can't get access through even legal routes because of these policies that have been introduced. And so many people are talking now about what else they can do. They're either thinking about crossing the Rio Grande or paying smugglers to put them in the back of tractor trailers that can become over 100 degrees. I mean, they're very dangerous, but people are desperate. And so they're resorting to more and more dangerous means as a way to try to get into the country.
You're seeing them taking more risks.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, there was frequent talk of the potential for crossing the river. Well, I was walking around Matamoros talking to people there. And, you know, interestingly, what people told me was that after this mother and child died just last week, you would expect perhaps that there would be a sort of hiatus, that people would stop crossing the river. But instead, bunch of people crossed the river immediately after that happened. I mean, it's like a panic is the best way that I can describe the situation right now.
We're talking about the surge of Central American families crossing the border this year and how a reporter tells that story. New York Times national immigration reporter Caitlin Dickerson stays up. We'll continue this on the Ideas Network. News is next. It's the morning show, and we're learning about a reporter's work on the ground covering the border crisis. Apprehensions at the U.S.-Mexico border, they fell from July to August, but they do remain at historically high levels. And in August, there were 64,000 migrants who either crossed the border illegally or who presented themselves at ports of entry without a valid visa. So what do you want to know about the situation at the border? What is unclear to you from the reporting that you see? Join in with your questions, 800-642-1234. Be part of the conversation with Caitlin Dickerson. She's a national immigration reporter at the New York Times, and she stays with us. Caitlin, you often highlight the experiences of migrants who have faced a lot of hardship as a result of immigration policies here in the U.S., but we do see those number of migrants going down, the year-over-year numbers, the month-over-month, July-August numbers. How do you respond to criticism about who you choose to focus on in your work as we do see the number of migrants going down across the border?
That's interesting. We get responses of all types at the New York Times because people love to, and rightly so, scrutinize and focus on our work quite a bit. But it's such a mix of stories that we present. I mean, just last week on the front page, I was involved in a story that was about the Border Patrol, specifically where my colleagues and I had interviewed more than 24 members of the Border Patrol. And for me, I approach it like I would covering any other topic. With regard to immigration, you know, that means covering folks who are coming into the United States, but also the folks who are processing them into the United States, and also the folks who feel like their lives are impacted by newcomers to the United States. That's how you cover any other journalistic beat, is in that comprehensive way. And so we have to do it the same thing. And I'm lucky to work on a big team of journalists, writers, graphics editors, folks who work in audio, folks who work in video, who are all dedicated to this topic. So I think if you look at the body of work, it's pretty broad. But there's never enough time. There are so many important immigration stories right now because, as you've pointed out, policies are changing so quickly, really in an unprecedented way. And so we can never do all the stories that we'd like to do. If there was one thing we could change, that would be it.
You talk to a lot of federal agents, you dig for a lot of data, and as you've been writing about family separations, you found it really hard to get reliable numbers, reliable data. What's that like?
So it's difficult for a reporter. I mean, you know, working with the federal government, working with any government entity, there's always an inherent tension there as a journalist. We are trying to make sure that the public knows exactly how the government works. And in some cases, they don't want you to know. And that's not specific to any administration. So in the case of family separation, that was something that began about a year before it was announced publicly to the American public, and that impacted thousands of people, you know, by the time it was acknowledged publicly. And that was very difficult because I was hearing about this story. It felt very clear to my editors and I from the very beginning that this is an important thing. This is something that the public is going to want to know about. But we weren't getting straight answers from the administration. So we had to use other measures to try to get more information. And a main problem with family separation, it wasn't just that the government didn't necessarily want us to know that it was happening, but they weren't being tracked in any kind of a routine way. That's why you saw that very messy and protracted effort to reunify families, because it turned out that, you know, in the most simple way, when families were being processed into the country and separated, their immigration records were being changed such that there was no piece of data that could have been used to match a parent and child once they had been sent to far-flung parts of the country. Many of the children were sent to places like New York, like Seattle, like Michigan, up here in Wisconsin, and the parents in large part remained detained in Texas and Arizona and California. And so it was very difficult to try to track them down. And for me, difficult to try to come up with comprehensive numbers to tell people how many separations had taken place. There were just no records.
So even if you had wanted to do a Freedom of Information request to get some data, it just wasn't there for you to get?
Not necessarily. I mean, it would have had to be a very convoluted and complicated request that I probably would have had to go into court to fight for. And at the end of the day, what I got back would not have been comprehensive. Things are a little bit different now because mechanisms were put in place as a result of all those congressional inquiries into family separations last summer. So separations which continue today and which we still report on, they're not happening in the numbers that are as large as they once were, but they're still happening on a consistent basis. They're being tracked now. So I can request that data, and I can also file Freedom of Information Act requests that can aid in my reporting.
Talking with New York Times national immigration reporter Caitlin Dickerson. Let's take a call now. Steve is joining us from Sun Prairie. Good morning, Steve.
Morning. Quick question. I understand the Republicans' position about, you know, making sure that people come here legally and limit the number of people that come. I get that position. I don't understand the Democrat position. They say they're not for open borders, but yet they don't want to send people back who came here illegally. So wondering, what is their exact position?
Steve, thanks for the call. How do you layer the politics that is coming off of Capitol Hill on what is happening as you cover the border?
It's complicated, right? Because I think that not all politicians agree in the exact same way with what they'd like to do. I mean, I brought up earlier the Democratic debates and what various candidates have talked about, and some have really focused on doing the opposite of what President Trump has. But that doesn't really address the full scope of what's happening with immigration and the gaps and the inconsistencies in the laws as they exist now. Some of the candidates, Democratic candidates for president, have comprehensive plans. Folks like Beto O'Rourke, who grew up in El Paso on the border, who, because of his role in Congress and because of his just familiarity with the community, really understands the complexities and the nuance of the immigration law and its fullness. And so when I read his immigration plan, he's got something really for everybody. So just to answer your question, Steve, he doesn't want to decriminalize crossing the border illegally, but he would like to add more immigration judges to address the million backlog cases that exist right now. I think something that all the Democratic candidates seem to agree upon right now is fixing the conditions inside detention facilities, both short-term and long-term, particularly the facilities that are used to house children, so that people have enough food to eat, so that they have medical care, so that they're clean, things of that nature. Most Democratic candidates seem to oppose the idea of family separations. But beyond that, I mean, it really depends what policy you're talking about and what candidate you're talking about, because it's such a broad issue.
Take us to a tent city that you have seen in Texas, because a reporter can't go inside, I understand.
I think you're talking about the government tents.
The government tents,
because there, there's also, there are tent cities that people are living in when they're waiting to enter the United States. And those, you know, those are sort of lawless places, so anybody can go in. The tents where court is taking place now for folks who are enrolled in MPP, this policy that requires them to wait in Mexico while their asylum cases are adjudicated. That's right. Access by journalists has been very limited, though we did get somebody in last week at the last minute after a bunch of pressure. The administration decided, okay, we're going to let people in for a day. I mean, the concern there among people who have concern is that when you're having legal proceedings take place by video camera, where the judge is in one place, the government lawyers are in one place, and the migrants are in another place, does that give people a full opportunity to be able to present their case for asylum, especially when it's, you know, someone who's fleeing persecution, who's fleeing violence? These are complicated arguments to make, and by people who don't speak English sometimes at all, sometimes as their often as their first language, and so it can just be difficult to communicate and connect with a judge to explain to them your situation when you're speaking to them by video camera.
You mean they're teleconferencing in judges?
Yes. Yes, exactly. And also government lawyers. So you can, I mean, I try to have conference calls over video conference, and it's often futile. You often feel completely disconnected from the person that you're trying to talk to. It's hard to communicate. And I've sat in many asylum proceedings. I mean, when you're talking about a final hearing for an asylum case, this is a 3-hour long hearing where somebody's telling their entire life story and having to present evidence and describe in graphic and vivid detail horrific experiences that they've had, and trying to do it with an interpreter over a video camera. It's hard to do. And the other thing that I think a lot of people raise is that in the United States, courts are open to the public, and we're used to being able to get access. It's a measure of accountability that has existed throughout this country's history, and immigration court is occasionally an exception. And in this case, with these tent courts, it's also an exception. The general public, journalists, can't just go in and see what's going on. That's why I think there's been so much focus and attention on this approach the administration has taken to adjudicating the MPP cases.
What do you see going on in the area of humanitarian relief? Because on our program, we have talked to people who have gone down to volunteer at the border. We have, you know, a Wisconsin lawmaker in Congress who wants to see more robust volunteer efforts and humanitarian efforts to create some stopgaps here. Mm-hmm. What are you seeing in that area?
There's a lot of activity in the space of volunteer work and of donations. I think what I've seen is that groups who I've reported on, they often talk about a phenomenon where, you know, the New York Times will write a story, or the Washington Post or some other outlet will write a story, and all of a sudden these groups are inundated with donations. And oftentimes it's with donations that they don't need. You know, I've even had people tell me that after I've written a story, tons of people have gotten in their car and driven down to Texas from where they live in California or where they live in Arizona, and they're at the border and they're trying to donate and help, but they haven't done the research to figure out what's actually needed. And so sometimes those can be less helpful than one might think. But the volunteer networks at the same time who are there on a consistent basis along the border are very organized. So in the tent city where hundreds of migrants are living in Mexico, in Matamoros, where I just left, they're waiting to enter the United States. All those migrants are relying on food that's provided completely by volunteers. In that case, it's a group called Team Brownsville, which brings in 2 hot meals a day, and they feed hundreds of people, and they do it like clockwork. So it's kind of amazing to see how, just as many, many people have sort of have clustered at the southern border trying to get entry in the United States, just as quickly these volunteer networks have organized to address their circumstances.
Caitlin, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Caitlin Dickerson is a national immigration reporter for the New York Times, and she's currently the Center for Journalism Ethics Journalist in Residence at UW-Madison. And she'll be a panelist in a discussion about journalism ethics and the challenges of covering immigration stories at the Overture Center for the Arts in Madison tonight at 6:30. Lots more news for you today on the Ideas Network. Stay with us for On Point after 9 as we get the latest developments in the formal impeachment inquiry into President Trump. That's On Point after 9 on the Ideas Network. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.